Coping with crisis and capture in the field. Part of putting feet to your faith is getting into trouble, getting out of our comfort zone. The Bible warns us and records many crisis situations, natural disasters and man-made threats. Floods, famines, fires, earthquakes, epidemics, plagues, persecutions, riots, theft, wars, all these are in the Bible and a lot more. It wasn't raining when Noah started to build the ark. When the angels came and rescued Lot and his daughters and wife from Sodom, warned him, don't look back, but Lot's wife did look back. Joseph, although betrayed by his brothers, sold into slavery, wrongly imprisoned, yet he was able to rise to prominence and be effectively the governor of Egypt and save many people from a 7-year famine. The Exodus, destruction of the whole economy of the superpower of the world at that time, Egypt. The walls of Jericho collapsing, effectively like something like an earthquake. The fall of Samaria, capital of northern kingdom of Israel. The destruction of Jerusalem, twice. And the destruction of the temple, including in 70 AD. There are so many crisis situations recorded in the Bible and in early church history. Severe persecution of the church. What is our response? Psalm 46, verse 1 to 3. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging. Which great hymn was inspired by Psalm 46? One of the greatest hymns of the church. A mighty fortress is our God, ein fester Berg ist unser Gott. This was somebody's home in Rhodesia, and that's what it looks like now. They couldn't have anticipated that's what would happen to their beautiful home and farm, but that's the sort of thing that can happen. So what's the biblical principles for preparedness? Proverbs 22 verse 3, the prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. Now, simple can be a positive word in English sometimes, but in Afrikaans, simple is almost always negative, right? Simple is in the sense of being stupid. You know? And this is the sense in which Proverbs 22 verse 3 is speaking about. It is stupid to see danger and not to prepare for it. Proverbs 3 verse 25-26, have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence. We as Christians should never live in fear. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. But we should be prepared. Proverbs 6 verse 6-8 gives another balance. Go to the ant, you sluggard. What's another word for sluggard? Slothful or lazy. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. Ants are an example of extreme industry and hard work. And do you know the average ant can carry 8 times its body weight? And some ants can carry 16 times their body weight. I mean, what human can compare with that? Or just take how a cat can jump 6 to 10 times its length from a standing position. I mean, is there a high jumper in the world who could even jump his own height without a running start? And yet, God's got amazing creatures. And the ant can teach us something. The ant work hard. And bees work even harder. Noah is an excellent example of provision. He and his sons worked for years, decades, building an ark not only big enough for their family and their domestic animals, but also big enough for elephants and platypus ducks and every other kind of creature that God wanted in there. Even the creatures that weren't important to people for agricultural use. Because God wanted all of his creatures preserved. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. And the ark was a phenomenal work. So Christians are to wisely anticipate danger and we're to make provision for times of scarcity. We're not to fear the future, we're to fear God alone. Yet we are warned to plan for the future and to prepare ourselves for adversity because Job 5 verse 7, man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upwards. Man is born to trouble. Yeah? Trouble's going to come. And if you've got brothers, you know they get into trouble even quicker. And there's special angels assigned to little boys to ensure they grow up to adulthood. Well, I wouldn't be here, that's for sure. If you fault in times of trouble, how small is your strength? So a time of crisis, a time of it's like a test. And your teacher doesn't give you a test for you to fail. They give you a test because they want you to pass. And so every crisis that God allows into our life is there as some kind of test so that we can pass and go on. Acts 14 verse 22, we read that the apostles Paul and Barnabas encouraged the believers by telling them, we must pass through much hardship or much tribulation to enter the kingdom of heaven. And apparently this encouraged them. Now, what if you said this in the average megachurch today? Get thee behind me, Satan. I don't receive that. I mean, how many people today are going to be saying amen, hallelujah to, we must pass through much tribulation to enter the kingdom of heaven? But that's what Paul and Barnabas were teaching, and the Christians were encouraged because it's reality. 2 Corinthians 4, 8 to 9. We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. In fact, in one translation, it says knocked down, but not knocked out. So, what could possibly go wrong? How do you prepare for the unexpected? If it's unexpected, how do you prepare for it? Well, you notice in our mission, we reverse in to our parking place because always accidents happen when people reverse out. It's so much better to reverse in. You're facing the right direction easily. But when you're trying to launch a boat, reversing in seems to be the most logical thing to do. Some people don't think ahead. And sometimes you're in a car and you're thinking, what have I forgotten? I feel like there's something I've forgotten. And then, where did I put my handbag? You know? These things do happen. On the road to success, there are no shortcuts.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you forethought is helpful. And can you imagine? I mean, these engineers should be fired. I mean, can you imagine? You get that far and the two don't meet. It's like, that's pretty bad. Now, these are some examples of engineers and contractors who should not get paid. I mean, how are they going to solve this one? And what were they thinking? So, there's some bizarre ideas. What architect thought this was a good idea? But duct tape can fix a lot of things. And as I say, duct tape may not be able to stop stupid, but it can muffle the sound. And then you get ingenuity. Some people are really, really ingenious. You know, somebody threw away a motorbike that doesn't work anymore, now it's a bicycle. And you get Uber bicycles too. And this is balancing act. You see in Malawi and Zambia some phenomenal ability at juggling. I don't know how these people do it. Can you imagine the weight of that? This is really ingenious.
Oh,
yeah. Balancing act. You've got to move a whole lot of bricks and all you've got is a bicycle. Can be done. There are solutions. Some people just see a problem. Other people find solutions. And then you can see a Kawasaki on the road. And yep, there are camels out there too. And sometimes you think these people have overloaded the vehicle. You get that impression. And by the way, this is relief aid. You see the American shield on there. And okay, this person has not learned the basics of weight and the load limits. This is a one tonner because you're not meant to put more than one ton in this, right? So, yep. I think this vehicle is going to get very tired. And how much is too much? I mean, there are wires across the road too that you have to get under.
Whoa.
Yep. So, how many people can you fit on a truck in Africa? More. Exactly. All of them. And, yep. Well, that would not fit through a narrow gate. And if you thought our trains in Cape Town are bad, go to India. And I had an experience on a bus in Malawi where I was on this bus and a large woman sat next to me and pushed me up against the window and the whole window fell off. And I was sitting on the higher seat just above the wheel. And so from below my seat, the window's gone, the whole window. And so we're driving at night across Malawi, dirt roads, billowing sand, other buses coming past, and I'm just holding on to this in front. And this was hours of traveling on a bus, and they had everything. You know, the chickens, the goats, the whole deal. I don't know the story behind this, but it's got to be an interesting story. In fact, Calvin, just a few weeks ago, was on his way back from the Reformation Society, and he saw blue lights, heard sirens. They were having a race, six police cars going down the M5. So he took the side road to the left to go under the bridge, to go to Pines, and suddenly this police bucky came hurtling over the top of the bridge and crashed right in front of him. And Calvin said if he hadn't slowed down because of seeing the car chase, the high-speed car chase, which was going at 160 k's an hour down the M5, he would have been right under this vehicle. As it was, he was the first one on the scene and helped the police out and all of that. That made the news. The unexpected can occur at any time. So what can go wrong on a mission, especially when you go behind enemy lines for Christ? Well, first of all, expect delays. Delays are inevitable. And would you go over this bridge? If so, I wouldn't want to entrust you with our mission vehicle. But we have walked across this, but we haven't driven across it. I think a beaver could build a better dam than this. And floods. Back in 2015, we had the most phenomenal flooding in Mpumalanga. And we got to, we were stuck at back to the Bible because the vehicles could not get out. And it was totally flooded. There were crocodiles and hippos floating down the river past us, past the Bible College. And it was so heavy. The police had blocks to stop people going, crossing some of these, which were obviously flooded. And a taxi came hurtling past the police roadblock, went straight in, turned on its side, rolled upside down, and just floated away. Probably ended up in the Indian Ocean by Mozambique. It's just gone. And this is near Durban. This is the N2. Yeah, this is not far from the old Durban airport. Yeah, so these things can happen. You can bet that the municipality did not clean out the drainage gutters before the rainy season. And it happens. I mean, yeah, there's some serious... We would not cross rivers without someone walking ahead, feeling with hiking stick, testing. You don't want to rip the sump out from under your vehicle on some big boulder. You don't want to suddenly end up in some serious pothole there. So we'd have to pace our way out. And when you're in some rivers, be aware there can be mobile handbags or flat dogs, as we call them in Rhodesia. Expect wildlife on the road. In fact, there are some serious wildlife. And let me tell you, a kudu is not much short of about 750 kgs, maybe 800 kgs. You do not want one of these guys landing on your car. And the first rule of the road that I learned at school in Rhodesia was elephants have right of way. And in fact, elephants always have right of way. And I just needed a scratch, you know. Oh, that feels so much better. Yeah. And I mean, remember, it's his bush. I mean, this is his home. We just visitors. So another rule of the road is never cross a solid yellow line in the road. And yep, lines have right of way too, by the way. And lots of lines. You've got delays. And watch out, because lions have right of way. I mean, just don't argue with them. Never argue with the king. And they play rugby out there too, yes. And in the water, they also have right of way, by the way. And in some places, like Serengeti, you can have the cheetahs actually... Wow, this is interesting. Very... Yeah, what strange creatures are there. Okay, who can spot the leopard? How quick? Where?
Down there.
Where?
Down
the direction?
By the tree.
Yes.
By the tree.
Next to the tree, yeah.
There's the leopard. Okay. Wow. Now, if you take more than 2 seconds to spot the leopard, you know, he'll spot you. Make no mistake. So, just be very alert. When I went to... There's the leopard. Can you see? Eyes, ears, nose. This is how the military designed camouflage. They copied leopards and tigers because God's the author of, well, everything. I mean, he's the ultimate artist. So when I went for our first bush training course, the game ranger said, I've got no problem with you feeding the animals, but your parents will. And it took me a while to realize what he was saying. And then and he said, you may not see the leopard, but he'll see you. And this is what you call fast food. Look at this bird putting on the brakes and that one having done evasive action. I mean, this is fast. This is seriously fast. And here's a... This isn't an African leopard, and that's not an African crocodile. That's what they call a caiman in South America, and that is a jaguar. But Lenore and I have been hiking in the bush, and these rhinos decide to follow us, and they followed us for miles and miles, walking in. They're very friendly rhinos, but just remember rhinos have rights of way too. And when you hear a knock at the back door, you shouldn't always open. And then, of course, there's also scorpions. And by the way, the scorpions that have the big, big, big clippers and the small tail, not a problem. Bee sting and so on. But the little clippers, the light-colored guys with a big, thick tail, deadly. I've been bitten by one of those up in Noob Mountains. I was in the so-called shower, which is a few reeds balancing on rocks, using cups of water to wash and rinse, and I reached out for my towel, which was draped over the reeds or wickers or bamboo or whatever it was, and next thing felt this agonizing sting in my hand, and there was this one of those little guys with the small clippers and a massive tail, yellowish light colored thing, and I felt the poison instantly going up my arm. And there we were in Nuba Mountains, 5 hours flying time one way, if we had even had an aircraft, from nearest medical help in neighboring Kenya. And so at a time like that, all you could do is call elders to pray, as C.T. Studd said. And I churched people around, so I asked them to pray. And I felt this poison going all up here. I mean, it was heading past my shoulders, heading towards my heart. And I prayed, and I literally felt the poison going out my arm, right out through the fingertips. It was incredible. It was instant healing, most serious that I've ever experienced, because there was nothing you could do. I mean, what could you do? A poison like that in the Nuba Mountains, as remote an area as possible, there's no medical facilities around for thousands of kilometers, probably, as far as we knew. Expect bad roads. There are potholes this big. And this is some of the Shosheki Road. By the way, that's Carl Free, remember, the music teacher. He used to go on missions with us too. And that's what the roads can do to your tires. That's up in the Sudan. And here we are digging out a vehicle on. We went a couple of hundred Ks and it took us 12 hours. The roads are that bad. And an area where they used to be able to travel much faster by bicycle in a four-wheel drive Land Cruiser, we could take hours more than a bicycle could back in the colonial days when the roads were in a good shape. To cross rivers like this, we would walk ahead. I would walk ahead normally, feeling with the Mrs. Hunzi following. Of course, this is why we have our literature packed in plastic, in boxes, crates, duct taped, and you want to reseal every time, because when you cross the rivers, you can't afford your literature to get wet. And, of course, a lot of other people want to live. So we actually had these, we used these snorkels for our engines to breathe. I've driven through these rivers where the water's coming up to your chest height, and that's in a four-wheel drive vehicle. That's a pretty high clearance. And this, by the way, is a road. You notice, that's a river, there's a road. And expect challenges. There can be storms, fires. This is a picture from Australia right now. Australia's had 5 million hectares burned. Sorry? Arson. They have arrested 180 people already for starting the fires. I would venture to say that most fires today, whether South Africa, Australia or California, it's caused by communists or Muslims. It's a new form of terrorism. It's a cheap, easy way of causing a vast amount of damage. It's either jihadist with an Islamic goal or it's communist with their own goals. So this is awesome. Phenomenal damage. And then, of course, this is in our country. You can suddenly have buses burning and stones on a road. And anything less than a phenomenal four-wheel drive, you better turn back because you're not going to get over this easily. So what can go wrong? Well, the weather. You can have all kinds of breakdowns. We've had, I think the record on a frontline mission was 30-something punctures on a five-month mission. On the Africa Overland mission that Hunter went on, I think he said he changed tyres 16 times. Of course, you're not carrying 16 tyres. So you've got to repair until you get to a town where you can buy new ones and so on. So, how many did you have on that mission that you went on?
Somewhere around there.
16 sounds right. But yeah, so phenomenal. And this used to be the border post going into Sudan, by the way. I presume it looked different when you went through in 2011. But this is what you see inside Sudan. Shot up to see the Kenyan number plates and shot out.
That's the Sudanese
flag. Oh, sorry, that is the Sudanese flag. Quite right. And you can see the bullet holes in the vehicle. Sorry, there. You can see shot out and bullet holes here. So that obviously machine gunned this vehicle, just lying there on the side of the road, and who knows what the story is. When you see tanks that didn't make it down Ambush Alley, it improves your prayer life. We saw 12 shot-out vehicles in a 2-kilometer stretch. And that just makes you revive your prayer life, because when you're going into areas where hard-skinned vehicles didn't make it, what chance does your soft-skinned vehicle have of making it? Well, you need the grace of God, you need the angels, you need to know you're in the will of God, you know that you need to know you're called and you're exactly where God wants you to be. And let me tell you something you should not do. Our team here was traveling with the windows up, air condition on, listening to some music on the radio, when suddenly the car was rocked off its hinges by an explosion, and then they heard the afterburners of the jet. You can't hear an approaching aircraft if your windows are up, the aircon's on, and the music's on, or lecture, or whatever it is. You've got to have your windows down, you've got to have your hearing fully alert. It's like running in a place where gangsters want to mug you with the earphones in. Just like, you've got no situational awareness. So that this bomb just missed our vehicle, and that was a MiG coming past and literally dive bombed our vehicle and missed it by a few feet. Didn't miss this vehicle. And expect opposition. Especially if you're on a university campus, you can stand up and say something or try to preach the gospel in the mosque and expect some opposition. There are people out there who do not like the gospel and do not like Christians, like Boko Haram up in Nigeria. And just in case you didn't understand Arabic, chicken scratch up there, the Islamic Jihad, I think you get the impression, you know, what they say. This is not positive. And so this is Boko Haram. Expect persecution. This church in Sudan was bombed 10 times, destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time. It's the Fraser Cathedral in Loy. It's been a target for the Muslims. They had about 140 bombs around it, bomb craters. Other churches, schools bombed. This is normal. South Sudan, Nuba Mountains, huge amounts of destruction caused by the Arabs because of Islamic Jihad. This is another occasion, another place. This bomb did not explode. And if it had, it would have taken the church and the compound where we were staying and ministering off the map. The engineers of the SPLA dug it out, put that sign there. I said, why would you bother to deal with an unexploded bomb? He says, we need the explosives to give back to the Arabs. It's more blessed to give than to receive, apparently. Expect illness, like when we were locked up in prison in Zambia, in Lusaka Central Prison with 65 prisoners in an area 25 feet by 15 feet. By the way, you can pace it out. It's smaller than this room. 65 people. No plumbing, no electricity, no beds, etc. Lusaka Central Prison. This is later. Couldn't take pictures of time, of course. Didn't have any cameras, but it wasn't so nicely painted when we were in there. This is later after the socialist government being thrown out and our friends are taken over. But this is what these cells basically looked like. That was the only breathing holes that we had. corrugated iron roofs. We were cell 11 right there. How did we manage in prison? Well, the first thing is to make friends with the other prisoners. Because as we came in and as we were being, it was after a full day of being blindfolded, handcuffed, chained, traveled from Livingston to Lusaka, paraded through the streets of Lusaka, being smacked with rifle butts and prodded with bayonets. And as we entered into the prison cell, cell 11, which is where the presidential detainees were locked up, as it was pitch dark inside, and it was dark, the sun had already set outside, and as they opened the door and pushed us in, they said, "These men are South African terrorists responsible for the deaths of millions." Pushed us in, shut the door. Basically what they're saying to the prisoners is, "You can tear them to pieces, we don't care." So the first thing I did in the pitch dark is start preaching the gospel, like my life depended on it. And you know, we met other Christians in the cell, and attitudes changed, and they were our friends from the beginning to the end. I mean, they were good people.
How did you just start sharing the gospel with them? You're like, "Hi, I'm Peter, so I'm a Christian." And
I start off, "I greet you in the precious name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We're missionaries. We've been locked up for refusing to pay bribes at Cousin Gulu Ferry." So, I mean, immediately starting, "We're here in order to share the love of Christ and preach the word of God." So, you know, I immediately identified. And because, in fact, the guys in there, they all, in fact, they knew how unjust the government was. And next thing we met the next vice president in there. There was Godfrey Miyanda locked up in Lusaka Central Prison because he had said that sanctions would hurt Zambia more than South Africa. And he is a well-trained man, and Kahunda threw him in there. There was a Indian, Hindu, a man who had owned a mine in Zambia, which they confiscated and threw him in prison. There was a Muslim from Mali, from Timbuktu, literally from Timbuktu, who had been on a business trip, and they just decided to throw him in prison and take all his things. And there was a South African truck driver, Isaiah Moyo, who had lent money to some South African cadres from the ANC, who decided, instead of paying him back, does he say he's a South African spy? So he is thrown in there. So everyone had a story. And but we started off on the right foot, and before you knew it, these guys were on our side. We were all looking out for one another. There was great fellowship. In fact, still got friends from cell 11, presidential detainees from Lusaka Central. Psalm 27 is the verse we read the morning we were captured in Cousin Gulu Ferry. "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evil men advance against me to devour my flesh, when my enemies and my foes attack me, they will stumble and fall. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war breaks out against me, even then will I be confident." Now, we had here, a few years ago, Heather Mercer come and minister at our devotions in this boardroom and be at our home and so on. And her book's here. Heather Mercer's this, the shorter one. Donna Curry is the taller. And so Heather Mercer was out here. And when she came for meal and I read before supper Psalm 27, she got so excited and she said, "That's the passage God gave us when they were locked up in Afghanistan, sentenced to death for the crime of showing the Jesus film to four Muslims at separate occasions on their laptop for showing the Jesus film." They were sentenced to death by the Afghan Taliban. If it hadn't been for 9/11 and therefore George Bush declaring war on them and sending in the SEALs, they wouldn't have rescued them. I mean, America was not going to stop them being executed. It was only the war that gave them a reason to actually rescue them. So, but Psalm 27, exactly same passage. And this was going through our heart and mind in our weeks in Lusaka Central and in the lives of Donna Curry and Heather Mercer as well.
Psalm 27.
"And on the road you will see some interesting things. You wonder what's going to happen when the motorbike stops. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13. "Be on your guard. Stand firm in the faith. Be men of courage. Be strong." So, practical principles for protection. You need mental, emotional, and spiritual preparedness. Philippians 4, verse 12 to 13. "I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation. I can do everything through him who gives me strength." Also, the will to win, determination, resilience, fighting spirit is basic to survival. You know, I've seen some of the biggest, fittest, strongest people fail on hikes and GCCs and in the field. And I've seen some of the smaller, slight, and not even that fit and healthy people succeed and persevere. It's not primarily physical, although it does help. But it's primarily attitude. It's mental, emotional, and spiritual preparedness that makes all the difference. For example, when we were locked up in Zambia, there were four of us. Now, there were two Rhodesian Sea Squadron SAS people with us. One chap was a Brit from England who had never been to any military, and there was myself. Well, one of the SAS guys basically lost his mind and was very aggressive, and I'm so glad he was taken off to a separate prison because he would have wrecked the testimony of the other three of us. But this Englishman, who we were quite concerned about because he had no physical training, fitness, military background, anything, but he was a dedicated Christian. But his attitude was right, and he came through with shining colors. The Australian, who had been Rhodesian SS, came through very well. And I came through very well. But this other chap, I mean, he crumbled. And he was a big, strong, tough, karate, black belt, everything, this and the other. But he could not handle being imprisoned, and he didn't handle that well at all. He really cracked badly. Trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger, sword, and all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Spiritual preparedness is the most important. The right attitude makes all the difference. So, to determine the level of threat, you must first gain a general knowledge of the regions, the history, the culture, and build up relationships with the local people that you're going to minister. Ask these questions. Who, why, what, how, where, when? 5 W's in nature, which is the questions you ask about anything in good journalism anyway. Who might wish to mount an attack against the mission? Islamic jihadists, communists, you know. Why? For robbery. There are a lot of places that they're just into robbery, sometimes retaliation. We've had people hating us because we were helping the Moro tribe, and they were of another tribe. And so you were helping their tribal enemies. It's like, but we're helping the Sudanese. No, but you're helping that tribe. And it's like, well, there are 27 tribes in South Sudan, and I thought we were helping the South Sudanese. No, you're helping our tribal enemies. Can you imagine? So riots, of course, ransom. In South America, there's a lot of that where missionaries get kidnapped and they want ransom paid. And most missions have the strict policy of never paying ransom because if they did that, that'd endanger all missionaries who would then be fair game for kidnapping to get ransom. So it's better that they know you're not going to get a ransom from mission anyway, ever. So that's actually been a good policy that saved a lot of lives. Do they want your supplies, your vehicle, your personnel? We've had oil drums of our stolen, expropriated, whatever they want to call it. We've had vehicles of our stolen afield. We've had bicycles we donated to evangelists stolen and appropriated by military personnel in the field. How might an attack be carried out? Ambush? Possible. Armed robberies? Possible. Hostage taking is possible. Where are you most vulnerable? When are you most vulnerable? If you've got a well-secured base camp, which we normally do, then the time you're most vulnerable is when you're traveling. In fact, the most dangerous time for all missionaries is when they're traveling, because the biggest killer of missionaries worldwide is vehicle accidents. That's just a fact. Traveling on the road is the most dangerous thing you do. When I just joined Hospital Christian Fellowship, my first mission, the entire Operation Mobilization Sudan team died in one vehicle accident. I don't know the reason. They don't know the reason. The combi with the leader and the entire team left the road on one of the mountains in the middle of Sudan, and they all died. And with them was lost all the cumulative knowledge and context, because it's a restricted access country. They didn't have things written down. They couldn't. So years of work and context and everything was just lost in one vehicle accident. I mean, you don't need an ambush or sabotage or an enemy action or an aircraft attack. Just driving tired, falling asleep at the wheel, things like that. Animal running across the road, swerving. these things can happen. And in fact, I remember John and Francis and Joseph and I were leaving on a major South African mission. John was driving at the time, and we were driving Plettenberg Bay area, Nature's Valley, forest on both sides, and an animal came running out across the road, and John swerved the vehicle, and we were heavily laden. We were just on our first day out, and we're fully laden trailer, and we swerved, we're on two wheels, swerved back, two wheels, right across the edge of the road, two wheels this way, and we're all just, no one is saying a word, we're just like holding on. And he finally steadied, and I don't know how we recovered, because we shouldn't have recovered. And after a long time, after we'd been going straight for a while, John says, "Is everyone okay?" And he said, "Are you okay?" obviously, to swerve was the wrong thing. To brake is acceptable. Although if you overdo it, you can get into a skid. But just a wrong move like that, that could have wiped out the whole vehicle, team, everything in one go on the first day of the mission. That sort of thing can happen. It can happen to any of us. I've fallen asleep on my motorbike driving through the Karoo and woken up with cars hooting, and I was drifting into other lane, and I was going 120 probably on a motorbike, and I totally was asleep behind the wheel. I've also fallen asleep driving a vehicle, and that was in days when you'd work through the night, leave at 2 in the morning, start driving. You know, I mean, we did some pretty crazy, stupid things. And I've fallen asleep at the wheel in the Karoo, also behind a vehicle with a trailer. And the reason why we didn't crash is just because God must have been super gracious, and an angel must have kept us together, because I do not know how we recovered from that swerve. To swerve at high speed, 120, on a road like that, it could be irrecoverable. It should have been, actually. So when you're most vulnerable, you've got to realize driving. So how do you solve this? The one thing is to try and get a good night's rest before you leave, which isn't normally possible. And if you can't, to switch drivers frequently. If you've got any chance, to keep switching drivers. Because, you know, you can stay focused for a couple of hours and switch the drivers. And, of course, having things to drink. And if it's cold, middle of winter, having some tea and so on to warm you up every now and then. But make no mistake, the biggest threat in Africa is not animals, it's not snakes, it's not crocodiles, it's not even diseases, it's not even the horrible terrorists and nasty people with AK-47s. The biggest danger is vehicle accidents. Statistically, that is when you're the most vulnerable. Determine your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities, and your threats. SWOT analysis. We should do this regularly. What are my or our missions and so on, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats? You can do this for teams, you can do it for families. Be aware of threat indicators. The threat indicator is when the people are cold or harsh, or especially the military, you get hostile graffiti like "death to all Americans." I mean, I've seen that one. In Boer Kop, one Jew, one bullet, death to America, death to Israel, graffiti on the walls, and you sort of think, this is a good time for Americans to suddenly become Canadian, you know, that sort of thing. Open anger, pilfering and theft by staff, which normally means they know that everything's going to get destroyed, so they might as well take things now. So these things would be indicators something serious is brewing. This is what a house looked like in Angola. And this sort of gives you the impression of what can go wrong. And this is how we used to travel. This is my bed camped out, backpack, ground sheet. The ground sheet's primarily to keep your body heat in and to keep the dew off you when you wake up in the morning. We didn't expect rain out there. And, I mean, that would be having tea in the morning. And security when traveling. Most security incidents occur during travel. Always know exactly where you're going and plan accordingly. Don't waste time on the road going in the wrong direction. Radiate confidence, but be discreet and unassuming. Don't be provocative. Be unprovocative when confronted with hostility. A soft answer turns away wrath. maintain a calm and mature approach to all situations, be alert to the possibility of confrontation with individuals and groups, and the best way to get out of it is to avoid it. If you can avoid a bad situation, avoid a conflict better. Keep your valuables out of sight in every way. And I mean, this would these days be people having their cell phones visible. You got a smartphone, you're a target, hide it. I don't have a smartphone. Makes things a whole lot easier for me. Make several copies of your passport, driver's license, ID, tickets, whatever's important. Always file a copy back here. We try to have an electronic copy and a hard copy on file. And that's been very, very helpful when people have lost things, had things stolen, been netboarded, and we could fax through at one time, scan through and send on attachment now. And it can often get people out of difficult situations if things have been lost. And then carry spares in different parts of your luggage. It's happened before that a person has had their passport stolen on board the aircraft in flight. Woken up in the morning, leave, and somebody's been in the overhead bin, stolen their passport. I mean, I always keep my passport on my person. And I carry these things in and out wherever I'm going. I don't leave it in a bag in an overhead compartment. That's not a good idea. We've had that stolen on overseas flights. My daughter Andrea arrived in America and to study at college, and her passport was stolen somewhere between Britain and America. She arrived there, but she had a color photocopy of her passport and so on, which solved the problem to allow them to let her in, actually, which was quite good of them. When she explained it must have been stolen on the way, and also when it checked, well, she couldn't have been checked in South Africa or gone through Britain, in this case, actually, Amsterdam, to get into America. So anyway, they let her in, even though she didn't have a passport, because she had a color copy. We've had other things happen like that. Always carry your original documents on your person. If traveling on trains, taxis, buses, discuss beforehand the fare before you get in, because otherwise they can charge you anything. If you say, taxi, take me, which typical in the movies, and then you arrive there and you know how much it's going to cost, and they can say anything, no matter how unreasonable, because you didn't check beforehand. Because if you ask beforehand, they are inclined to give a decent, and if it sounds too much, you can say, let me look for another one. He might bring it down again. You've got to haggle a bit to get a reasonable fare, or else, but if you don't ask, you can just add a zero to the price. I mean, what can you say? If you're in a place of different language, have the details, the address of where you're going, written out, especially if it's in Cyrillic script or Arabic or something. You know, you're in Egypt and you've got to explain Arabic how to go there. If you can show him the written address, it's like he knows how to get you there. If you're going to try and explain it in your terrible foreign accent, I mean, how's that going to work? So don't accept sweets or food from strangers, especially in the Middle East. You may wake up several hours later, find all your belongings gone, and maybe minus a kidney. I mean, really, these things happen. They love to give you drugged food or sweets, and a person wakes up destitute, if not one kidney or another organ missing, lying in a bath. I mean, that has happened. Tell you one of the classic stories from Sudan. People traveling by Land Rover across northern Sudan, where they knew there's a lot of banditry. So they slept inside the Land Rover. It just left the window a little open for a bit of air. They woke up about noon, sun's high. They feel drugged and overhung and everything's gone. Why have they got this hangover? It turned out the Arab bandits had pumped gas into their car, knocked them out, climbed in over them, stole everything around them, and I mean, they were so drugged out from this gas that came through the window that they didn't even know what happened. All they had was the underwear. Everything else, gone. Except, you've heard of people spiking drinks in nightclubs and so on. Well, I hope we don't go to those places, so it shouldn't affect us. But they spike food. They might offer you sweets and so on, and you could end up in deep trouble. In any hostel or hotel or guest house or backpackers, secure your doors. When you're inside the room, use locks and security chains. And if none's available, use chair or suitcase. I have been in places as diverse as Nigeria and Hungary and had prostitutes banging on the door in the middle of the night, being told there's somebody there, and the people in the reception have given them the details and given them a spare key. They're trying to get into your room. Yes, unbelievable. I mean, I remember this two Hungarian prostitutes grabbing me and trying to, you know, telling me cheap, and I was like, there's not enough money on the planet for you to pay me. You people are disease factories. Get lost. I'm married. No. I had to throw them out bodily. There's all kinds of people who are trying to sell you drugs onwards. There's no end of garbage that can happen. So you've got to think security. And, you know, I remember, back in the 80s when I was in my 20s, you'd check into a room, you wouldn't even lock the door. I mean, we didn't used to think of locking doors because I'd even be in hotels and so on. I didn't even lock the door. And it didn't cross my mind that that was a problem. You can't think like that anymore. Also, if you're in a high-rise building, try not to be on a ground floor because that's easy access to robbers. But try not to be above the seventh floor because if there's a fire, fire brigade can't help you above seventh floor. They don't have ladders that go higher than seventh floor. So a point like, I don't know if you've heard the different things that can have in Nigeria, buildings collapsing, Sao Paulo, entire high-rises catching flames and just about everyone in it gets consumed. So as someone who's worked in the fire brigade, generally speaking, anything above seventh floor, you can't be helped. I mean, there's not much they can do if it's a serious fire. And you don't want to jump from seventh floor hoping they're going to get you on the trampoline or whatever that they're carrying around there. Be alert to the possibility of being followed to your room. I've been followed to my room in Nigeria and Hungary and so on, and you don't want these sort of people or whatever they're offering. You're not interested in. So, traveling by vehicle is, this by the way, is our Land Rover that got destroyed in Angola on the way back in ambush. And that was the mission in 1994 when four vehicles went out into the field and only one came back. Try to avoid driving at night when possible. Our fatality of Anthony Duncan, 1994, was driving at night, through the night, when they were tired, coming back from ambush, arrest, imprisonment, and all the rest of it. They were beyond exhausted, and early in the morning, at early morning dusk, car overtaking a truck head-on. Try never to let your fuel tank fall below half full. Why would that be? There's several reasons why you don't want your tank to go under half full, because, first of all, there could be an emergency crisis and you need to drive your car a long distance and you may not have the time to refill. Secondly, you might get to a petrol station, they don't have fuel. That happens. That happens frequently. And the other reason is that you know that in the unlikely case of a vehicle exploding, it's never with a full tank. A full tank of petrol cannot explode. It's mostly gas. It's the gas in the tank that explodes. So in the army, we used to every night fill every vehicle tank full. Because if there's attack, mortars, whatever on the base, a full petrol tank cannot explode. It's the gas. So the more empty the tank is, the more liable it is to a fuel explosion. So a full tank, or mostly full tank, is obviously better than a mostly empty tank. Always travel with at least one other person. Although I must say, having said that, I've done probably more than half of all my missions alone. Keep a spare key for the vehicle. Ensure your co-driver's got the spare key on him. We've had it before where a person's locked both keys in the van. We've had it before where they didn't have a spare key. I even had a time when I was going on a mission, talking about 1985, in a Bucky, and we only had one key, and I'd asked my co-driver, please get a copy made. He didn't get a copy made. We were driving in this vehicle, and we had a bit of an engine knocking sound as we're approaching Masvingo. That's old Fort Victoria. He gets out, opens the, and this man's a trained mechanic, and with the ignition key, he starts to fiddle in the engine. I said, is that? He says, no, these things are very strong. And about that time, snap. Ignition key broke. Fell into this hot tank. I mean, you can't put your hands in it. We've just been driving who knows how long. This is Zimbabwe, summer, very hot. And so we had to wait quite a while before we could even get that key. Then walk into town. By then it's Saturday afternoon. Locksmith's closed. Go to the police. Found the home of where the locksmith was. Had to come out there. I mean, we're talking about 4 or 5 hours wasted just because we didn't have a spare key. So that sort of thing. And then, of course, it cost a lot more if we'd just gone downtown in Joburg and gotten it done. But then there's another time when having a spare key. Now, if you're on a motorbike and you're only driver, you've got to have your spare key. I mean, there's no one else to share it with. So one of my first missions to Swaziland, I'm approaching an intersection and a policeman stands up there. And so I stop in front of him. And he steps forward and he takes my key out of the ignition and says, "Why didn't you stop?" I did stop. "You didn't stop. How do you have my keys in? The royal family is going to be passing by here this afternoon. We respect the royal family in Swaziland. You needed to stop." I did stop. "You didn't stop." Now, I realized after a while, there was a certain distance I was meant to have stopped. I maybe stopped too close to him. I mean, I didn't nearly run him over. I stopped what I thought was a reasonable distance, but from his perspective, I was too close. And obviously, I didn't understand Swazi culture, my first visit. And so he's got my keys, and he said, "You didn't stop. Now, how do you have my keys?" And anyway, so he then, at a certain point, after this dragged out for about an hour, he said, "You must pay a fine of something in the region of 100 rand," which in 1982 was a phenomenal amount of money. I mean, if I tell you that our salary in the army on the border was 200 rand, and in training it was 100 rand a month, you'll understand that a fine of 100 rand was, there's no way I've got that money, amount of money. Kidding. And so he says, "Then your bike is confiscated." I said, "Well, a bike's worth a lot more than 100 rand. It's just worth over 1,000 rand. And so he's still got my keys. And he storms off. I thought he had a spare set of keys. So this has carried on for an hour and a half. So put my key in, turned around, and I was pretty nervous for the next hour or so. But anyway, at least I had a spare set of keys. But I'd lost the originals. These things happen. Constantly check your rearview mirror. By the way, one time I was coming out of a mission to Malawi and Mozambique, and I was coming back through Zambia, and I went across Kazangula Ferry into Botswana. So I'm in Botswana, and this chap at the customs says, "Anything to clear?" And I said, "Just some baskets and woodwork." "Oh, you can't bring baskets and woodwork through Botswana." I said, "But these are things I bought on the side of the road in Malawi and so on." "Well, you must go back, and you must go back to Blantyre," he says, "and have them airlifted to South Africa, air freighted." I said, "You think that's an intelligent suggestion? I'll drive another 1,300 kilometers back to Blantyre and air freight these baskets and woodwork I'd bought on the side of the road." "Yes," he thinks that's the best thing to do. I said, "Do you know the cost of petrol and the cost of air freighting? Why? No, it might bring foot and mouth disease in the country." I said, "This is a closed bucky. It's inside the country. How on earth can this cause foot and mouth disease in Botswana? I'm in transit. I'll be out of your country by nightfall." And anyway, he just carried on, would not let this pass. Asked to see the senior. I spoke to the supervisor. Nobody is willing to let me go through Botswana with the baskets and woodwork that I'd bought on the side of the road from Malawi through Zambia on the way back as gifts to people. So I'm sitting there, and they're all wanting to ignore me, so they just disappeared. And I see from the counter here, you know, like Marion's desk, he's got an upper counter and there's a lower counter where they're working. I see the stamp. So I've got this piece of paper which has already been stamped from immigration, but now it needs a second stamp from customs. So I reached over, stamped it, put it back, and sort of drifted out, went to the gate, and was I nervous for the next several hours. But I got out of Botswana safe. But I mean, just for baskets, for goodness sakes. Anyway, these are things. So, in some areas, travel by convoy is the safest, and sometimes it's the only permitted way. In many places, like to go through northern Uganda when the Lord's Resistance Army was going berserk, you had to travel in convoy. Some parts of Sudan, you had to travel in convoy. Identify a leader for each vehicle as well as an overall team leader to be obeyed regarding all safety issues. So when it comes to safety, security, life-threatening there must be one person who's making decision. Because sometimes even a wrong decision is better than no decision. Or you can't have a discussion in the middle of a crisis. You know, whether you're driving through, whether you're going back, whether you're stopping, whatever it is that you're going to do, one person should have the responsibility. The most senior, experienced person on team needs to take that responsibility. And you can't have people arguing. And we've had some individuals who wanted to argue in the middle of a crisis, even, for example, in the middle of being ambushed and shot at. So maintain the agreed-upon convoy speed. Are you going to drive through? Are you going to go at whatever speed? You've got to decide this. You can't suddenly lose your other teammate. It's not often we travel with several vehicles, but it does happen. When I went to Eastern Europe the first time with Bill Bethman and his wife's in the front vehicle, Lenore and I and the one behind, we're both in German Mercedes rental vehicles. We've rented from Frankfurt. And we're on Autobahn. Germany's Autobahns have got no speed limits. No speed limits. And so Bill Bethman's tearing down at who knows how many mucks. I'm, you know, at 160. And Lenore's saying, you're losing them. Go faster. And I've never gone over 160. And these vehicles are spinning past us on both sides. And like at light speed, sort of, you know, Star Trek type of movement. And, I'm up to 220. And Lenore's saying, faster, you're losing. And I've never gone at this speed. This is faster than they were flying aircraft in the First World War. And you know, Bill Bethman, where's he? He's gone. And I got up to 260 k's an hour, and Porsche comes zipping past me so fast you could barely see him. And to keep up with Bill Bethman was really tough. I mean, he is like a race car driver out there. And he knew the German Autobahns, but my first experience with German Autobahns was terrifying. Had no idea you could drive that fast. I did catch up with him sometime later in the day. Discuss your strategies in the event of all possible contingencies beforehand. I mean, if you're going to get ambushed, what's your plan? Are you going to go opposite side of the road, get out the other side of the vehicle? Are you going to try and drive through? Are you going to try and drive through the people ambushing you? You've got to look at the terrain and determine your strategy. Because it's a long way to Sudan, and there's a lot of casualties on the way who did not make it. And these should remind us. Check your vehicle daily. You do not want your vehicle to break down in the middle of an ambush or in the middle of a crisis or in the middle of a place where, you know, you've got a whole lot of bad people out there who want to eat you. So try not to travel without a communication system. This used to be harder. We used to only be able to have shortwave radio in our cars. And then we were able to get satellite phones, which is phenomenal. Now you can apparently use cell phones in an Uber sometimes, which is mind-boggling. This is, for me, such a quantum leap. Unbelievable. But there we go. So now, as long as you've got the right SIM card and whatever else you need. It's not always available. For the first several times we went to the New Mountains, we had satellite phones, which you've got to pay a fortune for, and it costs a mind-boggling amount of money for every few minutes and so on. But I mean, it was the only way of communicating. And there were other times we went in just with shortwave radios. And in fact, back in the 90s, shortwave radios was the only way. And then it was satellite phones in the 2000 on, and now it's cell phones. So, have your travel documentation, vehicle papers in order and accessible. In other words, don't be the kind of person who's folding out this paper. And folding, you know, have a flip file. And you pull out your flip file, and yeah, I've got these where you literally pull it out, and it's all in Perspex folder, and they can see all you, and they're already feeling a bit discouraged because you've got all your ducks in order, and you've got your letters of introduction, you've got your letters of invitation, you've got your authorizations for this, you've got your triptychs, you've got your automobile association stuff, and it's like, ugh. You know, they're not going to be able to charge you, and you immediately look prepared, professional, organized. But if you've got it looking like a dog's breakfast that's been eaten by your dog at home and so on, well, that's just an invitation for trouble. The roads are bad, frequently. Some places, we fly the Christian flag because friendly fire is not friendly. And you don't want to be shot by your own side. So we were in places where most vehicles would belong to Arabs. And so in times like that, you want to fly the Christian flag so that at least your side won't shoot you. You know, it's bad enough to be shot by the enemy. It's terrible to be shot by your own side. Checkpoints must be approached with caution, especially in the evening. I mean, at night, you got to approach a possible checkpoint with windows open so that you can hear instructions saying, you know, you may not understand the language, but you understand it probably means stop. And at night, you've got to dip your lights. In some areas, like Sudan, they'd require you to switch off your lights. Of course, you shouldn't be traveling at night if you know what's good for you, but sometimes we were. And then they want you to switch on internal lights so that they can see who it is and then, you know, come to a complete stop if ordered to do so, obviously. Keep your hands visible at all times. Consider offering a friendly handshake, which normally works fine in Sudan. If your vehicle's searched, protest, but, I mean, it's not worth resisting. Follow them if they want to look at your boot. I get out and I go and I open the boot. I don't, because you don't want them planting something. Oh, you're traveling with drugs in your boots. Or, you know, like, if you walk around there, that's always better. If they want to remove things, ask for a receipt. If none's provided, keep a record. I mean, you've got to have, everyone should always travel with a notebook and a pen and things like that. We've got to be, you know, torch, obviously, things like that. So, for a lot of our travels, it's been by motorbike. Do you know the name of Frontline Fellowship originally was Motorbike Mission? And when we went to Sudan, my first transport was a motorbike. We took this motorbike, put it into the aircraft, flew it off, so I had a form of transport in there. Problem, there are rivers, no bridges. There weren't any bridges then. And so we'd have to get across that way, and at least was a light enough motorbike of 185 that you could lift up and put in. And the local people were friendly enough to lend us AK-47s and Tokarovs and Makarovs and what have you. But next problem, there's no garages. There's no fuel. So we had to take our own fuel, pre-position our fuel, or limit what you traveled with. So understanding the practicalities of the roads and what you're dealing with on the road, this particular time was... It's a chapter in our Faith Undefined Sudan called What Can Go Wrong on a Mission. Everything went wrong, including Hansi, this chap over here in the blue overalls. He got sick with tetanus, and we ended up walking. I walked hours and hours through the night with one other chap, an American Ranger chap, and we walked down the road, and it was nerve-wracking because we're heading towards Yei, which was the headquarters of the SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, during the war. So we're in a war zone, and we're traveling to a new area where they speak a different language. We were well-known in Moraland, we were well-known in Zundiland, we were well-known in Buriland. We're now going to Yei. These people there, most of them were Dinka, HQ. We don't know them, we don't know the people there, at least not personally. So we're walking down the road, pitch dark, and of course you can't use a torch. And anyway, it's a war zone. So this sounds bizarre, but as we're walking out of the darkness, suddenly comes a soldier walking with his rifle ready. Another one, staggered, like Z formation, coming down the road. And I'm walking down the middle of the road and said, good evening, good evening, good evening. And the eyes grew wide and I kept walking. No one said a word, and I walked right down the middle with SPLA soldiers passing me on each side. This is something like 3 or 4 in the morning. Kept walking, they disappeared in the distance, we kept going. I don't know what they saw, but we walked through a patrol in an operational area without them stopping us, which is bizarre. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but they should have challenged us and all that, but I mean, who knows. We get to this town, now we know we're approaching Yei. This could be really bad, because they hear someone approaching, they might open fire without even challenging it. So we're going very quietly and carefully. I can smell the smoke. Fire smoke, cigarette smoke, walking carefully, carefully. Next thing, there's the chalk line. There's the barrier. Here's the outer roadblock. Where are the soldiers? We walk around it. There's one sleeping. There's another one sleeping. There's another one sleeping. We step over some of them. And we're in Yei. We passed through the outer checkpoint and not one person was awake. Praise God, because who knows what might have happened if they had been awake. Borrowed this bike from a mission inside there. I went back out to get help to get Hansi, who is now delirious, get him flown out. And get our vehicle towed out. And we ended up on bicycles. This is the mission where we started with planes, went down to boats, vehicles, motorbike, bicycles, ended up doing on foot. In fact, this is at the end of the night when we had walked through the night to get to the place in Gay. And my trousers couldn't be more muddy. I mean, waded through mud to get there. And on this occasion, we're between enemy lines and being offered this Arab skull. What can go wrong? Well, the planes can crash. This is a plane that I first flew into Noob Mountains in, a British Lockheed, and Hawker. And it crashed on another mission into the Nuba, but it wasn't our team with it. It ran out of airstrip before it ran out of airspeed. Still there. And, of course, footing, as they call it, hiking up and down the mountains, a very key, interesting, fascinating sort of place. All kinds of weapons that these chaps have there. General principles, try not to walk alone. Try to have other companions, particularly from the local area, can be guides and translators and communicate. Be aware of your surroundings. Avoid groups of people loitering on the streets. Avoid walking too close to shrubbery or other place where an assailant could be concealed. Don't carry all your cash or valuable materials in one place. Have several separate pockets or pouches. Some missionaries have said to me, you should always have a dummy wallet or purse. And if they ask, you've got a couple of notes that you use for some basic things and a couple of cards, and they're probably expired. So you've got a dummy wallet in the obvious place, and then you've got your real one. And I did that a couple of times. Never needed to use it, but I've heard from some people that was useful. Women should particularly be cautious and not feel pressured to forgo common sense to prove herself in the field. You don't need to be silly. Better to suffer embarrassment from being overcautious than to be the victim of an attack. So, to dress and to behave conservatively and modestly and not to display valuables and jewelry is better. If you feel someone's following you, cross the street. If necessary, cross back to check if they really are following you. And if necessary, don't hesitate to call out, scream, shout, run, sound the hoot or horn of your vehicle or whatever. And single women could consider wearing a wedding ring, in especially Muslim countries. That could be considered very advisable. Consider and rehearse the actions you take in the case of a confrontation. Self-defense is mostly mental preparation, knowing how to behave when faced with danger. But every situation is different. Some cases you can talk or walk your way out of it. Other times you need to shout for help. Sometimes you need to flee. Other times you need to fight. And those occasions can come. So have no fear of sudden disaster or the ruin that overtakes the wicked. The Lord will be your confidence.